Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for TWiT specials is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT Live Special number 277, recorded March 16th, 2016. The Game Developer Conference, 2016. This TWiT Live Special is brought to you by Texture, the mobile app that lets you access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your phone or tablet. For your free trial, visit texture.com/twit. When you think of tech companies in Silicon Valley, you probably think of Twitter, Google, Apple, Facebook, the giants of the industry. But when it comes to profit, when it comes to mindshare, where it comes to pure imagination turned into something strange, weird, and wonderful, you have to think of video games. Which is why we're here in San Francisco at the Game Developer Conference, and I've managed to pick up a stray. That's right, folks, it's OMG Chad. Chad Johnson, formerly of the Twit TV Network, now of the OMG Chad Network. Chad, what are we here to see?
One of the things I'm most excited to see is VR. VR is taking over the video game industry. I want to see what Sony's VR is like. I want to see all the other competitors. That's just one thing at a massive conference here in San Francisco that I'm excited to see.
Without further ado, let's get working. Let's get gaming. You've seen VR, but have you seen PlayStation VR? I'm standing next to Richard Marks. He's the director of the PlayStation Magic Lab. And Chad and I just tried out a fantastic demo of the PlayStation VR. Tell me, what's the secret sauce? What do you think makes this just a cut above its competitors?
Well, there's a lot of different things that go into VR. We really aim for a very high-quality spec, but also it works with the PlayStation 4. So you can just plug it in, and it'll just work. And it's really comfortable. We worked really hard to make it comfortable, easy to put it on and take off, so you kind of forget that you're in VR while you're wearing it. All those things together make for a really high-quality VR experience.
What were the technical hurdles with this unit?
Well, with VR, you have to have a high refresh rate. So we have 120 frames per second refresh rate on the panel. You have to have really good optics to make things look like they're literally all around you like that. And then also you need a really low latency so that the tracking really feels like everything's moving the right amount. So all those things together combined with like making the graphics all rich and in a good environment around you is, you know, why VR is so challenging.
Let me ask you a little bit about something. You mentioned the refresh rate, making sure it's 120 hertz. And I know that does cut down on the motion sickness that some people will feel when they're trying out VR products. But that's not it. I found your tracking to be dead spot on. I think that lack of lag actually adds to the non-nausea experience of VR. How do you do that? I mean, because I've seen good demos before, and I've always felt a little queasy after 5 or 10 minutes. I played this for 10 minutes straight, and I felt fine.
Well, there's a few things. Of course, we do have a high refresh and low latency. There's gyros and accelerometers in here that are being used. But one of the keys is the PlayStation 4 is a known quantity. So we can really tune things exactly knowing the hardware. It's not like we have to leave a little bit of slop in for different kinds of hardware. Every PlayStation 4 is exactly the same, so we can really, really tune it up.
So we used the Move controllers in our demo, which I think is one of the best movement controllers around. You know, you see HTC, you see Oculus trying to come up with competitors. But this has been in the market for years. And so mention the controller system, what is your ethos with that moving forward?
Well, actually, so the PlayStation Move has been around since the PlayStation 3, but now we're using it with the PlayStation 4 camera. So actually, you get an improved precision on the tracking of the PlayStation Move from what you had before. And, you know, we also have the DualShock 4, which also has a light bar and gyros and accelerometer, so that also is tracked. And there's some games where you look down and you can actually see the controls and you can see them highlighted. So when you press a button, it kind of shows you like a tooltip or something of what's happening, what that button would do. So those things are really great to have that tracking in there in VR too.
Richard, one of the big advantages that PlayStation is going to have over some of its competing products is, as you mentioned, it's designed for the PlayStation. You know the hardware. You know exactly how every console is going to act. You know exactly what is in the hardware of every single piece of equipment that's ever going to be connected to this. So how will you use that to your advantage? What kind of games, what kind of applications can you develop for the PlayStation VR that you wouldn't be able to do for something else that, say, plugs into a generic PC?
Well, one of the big things by knowing everything is the developers can know that the experience they craft will be the exact experience a player gets when they try it in their home. So that's a huge advantage. The developers know, you know, they're giving the people what they intended to. And then also because it is so easy, you know, getting in and out of it is very quick and there's not any complication. You can have a really wide range of experiences. You could have these kind of very small experiences that are short, but you could also have a, you know, very deep, long experience. We have some great experiences we're showing that here. You know, we're showing the VR Worlds, which has five different experiences. We have Playroom VR, which we announced comes with every one of the PlayStation VR systems. You can download it as soon as you get it. So there's a lot of different titles. We announced there will be 50 titles during the launch window.
I'm glad that you mentioned games, because as a gamer, a system could be amazing, but without the games, you really have nothing. So how much does it cost, and when is it available?
So it comes out in October, and it's $399 for the base system, and then there's already like 230 developers working on titles for it. So there's a long pipeline of games coming.
Richard, if they wanted to find out more about the PlayStation VR, more about the PlayStation ecosystem, where can they go?
Well, if you search for PlayStation VR online, you'll find all sorts of things. And, you know, we have a lot of things about it on our website, so you can check out PlayStation.com.
I'm at the Manus VR booth, and I'm talking to Stein. So what are we seeing here at this booth?
Well, this is the Manus VR glove. It is the first consumer virtual reality glove.
And so controlling things in VR is kind of a problem. You could either solve it with the solution of a controller, but you kind of have an issue of not being able to see the buttons, and you have some way of maybe scanning your hands, and this gives a great sort of merge of the two. So does it have individual finger control, or, you know, what are the features that the actual glove has?
Right, so we think virtual reality is all about immersion into the virtual world. So what we do is we try to measure the hand as accurately as possible and send that data as quickly as possible to the headset without delay. So it has all sorts of sensors integrated into the glove, custom sensors that measure the way your fingers bend. So we measure the various joints, we measure orientation, we do position of the hand as well, and position of the wrist, from which we can infer position of the arm. So we try to measure as much as possible with as little technology as possible. Yeah.
That's great. And what would this be compatible with? Which VR systems?
Well, currently we're demonstrating HTC Vive compatibility. We are working on an OSVR compatible system, and in the future we are planning on, of course, supporting all of the systems like Oculus, PlayStation VR, and mobile headsets as well.
Now, are you ever going to add any sort of buttons, or that's just right out? Like, you guys are focused on the hand experience.
Yeah, currently we are focused on hand presence, but we are working on some stuff that I cannot talk about yet. You're going to have to come back next time. But there are a lot of ways to expand a system like this that we have built into all sorts of props and other trackables and fun stuff.
Right. Like, I think that the dream with VR would always be texture and maybe resistance. Now, have you guys seen anything like that in the industry?
Yeah, there are some gloves who do very extensive what's called haptic feedback, so touch feedback from the game. We try to make a product that's really realistic and affordable and can be on the market now instead of in 10 years. So we have limited it to one rumbler on the hand that is enough to detect the edge of objects or rumble the controller when you drive off the road in a racing game. In the future, though, we are doing a lot of research for adding feedback to the fingertips and making it more sophisticated. But this works very well at the moment.
Great. Are there any other styles, or is just one sort of glove style?
Well, we're going to release different sizes because it's a very easy technology to scale. But currently, this is the only style that we have.
And what's the price point?
$250 for a developer kit, which includes a pair of gloves and a pair of bracers that allow you to strap the Vive controllers to your arm for tracking the position.
Perfect. And what is the release date, or is it out already?
We are going to release it in Q3 of this year.
Where can people find out more?
At menace-vr.com.
We've got goggles for your face, gloves for your hand, but what about your feet? That's why I'm sitting next to Stanislas Tenet from 3D Rudder, who's going to explain why this might be your next VR accessory. Stanislaus, what is this?
Hi, this is a feet-based motion controller you use while seated. So basically, all you do is you sit, you rest your feet on it, and by tilting the device forward, you move forward in the game. So it's very intuitive. It takes about 4, 5, 6 seconds to get used to all the movements you can do. Forward, backwards, strafe right and left, steer right and left, and move up and down, and combine everything together. And then you can really enjoy the experience of VR in the comfort of your couch or your gaming chair. It's very intuitive, very addictive, actually.
Well, this is one of the things that we've seen with VR tech over the last two decades, which is we can figure out what we need to do for your eyes to fool them into thinking they're in a virtual world. We can figure out what to do with your hands. We can even, to a certain extent, figure out how to track the head and shoulders. But it's difficult to do something with the feet, because as we move, our feet want to move. They want to walk, and very few systems are set up to do that. This doesn't exactly duplicate walking, but it does give your feet something to do. Is that what you were going for in the design, to get the whole body involved in VR?
Well, first, I don't know if the whole body is going to be involved. I think, you know, it's like in every technology, you think of something, you want to translate everything you do into the technology or the experience, the digital experience, but it doesn't work that way. We believe that players are lazy, and I say that in a good sense. I'm a player, so yeah, I'm a gamer. I'm lazy, and I don't want to walk a lot. I don't want to run in VR. I want to sit and enjoy my, you know, at the end of my day or during my weekend, I'm going to play, and I want that experience to be relaxing. And that's why we thought you want to be sitting when you play. And this, you know, gives you a feeling that you're actually moving, and it does the job so well that actually it gets rid of the nausea that some people experience with VR. I was doing a VR mixer on Monday night, and about half of the people who tried it told me, oh, it's great, I don't experience VR motion sickness anymore. And I think that's the key about this device. It really emulates movements without being actual movements.
Oh, where do you see this being used? Because obviously you want to integrate it with products like the Oculus Rift or the HTC Vive. But this is an additional control. How many games or applications will be able to take advantage of it?
First, we're seen by the PC as a joystick. So basically any game that has a joystick input can use our device. We show on our website demos of The Witcher, of Need for Speed, or using Google Earth, actually flying in Google Earth with this. So it's pretty much everything. It's clear that when today a lot of the games in VR are developed without movement or with some awkward movement settings, like you point to a place where you want to go, and that's where one of the issues of motion sickness comes in, because you're kind of disconnected with what's actually going on in the game. Where with this is very natural. And so we think that for exploration games or racing games or any games where there is movement, this is an outstanding peripheral.
All right, Stanislaus, let's talk about pricing and availability. When will they be able to pick one of these up? How much is it going to set them back? And if you could, give them an address where they can find out more information about what you're doing with the Rudder.
So you can buy these for $175. It's available on our website, 3drudder.com. We deliver within 3 to 4 weeks, so it's available. It's just a lead time to send it to you, to ship it to you. And by September, you'll find that at the launch retailers for consumer electronics or games. They'll carry VUS as well.
Hey guys, Chad here at GDC 2016, and we're in the Swedish gaming arena, and we're going to talk to Pieces Interactive, and I'm talking to Robert about their new game, Kill to Collect. So if no one's seen Kill to Collect before, give me a brief overview of what the game is.
It's Kill to Collect is a cyberpunk action roguelike with up to 4-player co-op. It's a very, we call it strategic combat. It's a very challenging game. You need to read and understand your enemy before attacking, or else you'll fail.
Right. So I got to experience about 10 minutes of gameplay. One thing that I noticed right off the bat, really cool music. So congratulations on that. And it's a top-down sort of isometric where you're clearing room to room. Is there any sort of story, or is it just kind of procedurally generated roguelike?
So it is procedurally generated, but we have a story campaign. There are actually three game modes. We have a story campaign with story beats. Then we have leaderboard-based daily challenges. And we have a free hunt mode where you can just go out and hunt whatever you like.
Sounds great. And how many players in your team can play?
You're up to four-player co-op. And there are features in the co-op that are not present in single-player. For example, you can revive each other and help each other out. So, yeah.
Now, I had a character that I was playing. Is there any customization with that character?
You can select from a few different loadouts when starting the game. Different guns, different types of power-ups. And at the end of each floor, you can actually power up your character. But since it's a roguelike, it's only for that bounty. So you start from scratch again.
Sounds good. So are you hoping to just get the most amount of points at the end, or is there ever going to be any like PvP sort of situation?
There's no PvP. At the end, each bounty is a certain amount of floors, and then you have a boss fight, basically, or a gang fight, which are connected to boss. So that's the gameplay.
What was the inspiration behind this game?
Yeah, art-wise, it's very much like cyberpunk, Japanese cyberpunk Appleseed. And when it comes to gameplay, we looked a lot at Binding of Isaac and Spelunky. Yeah,
I was wondering, Spelunky, because of the daily challenges to clear a whole area. When do you hope to release?
We'll release during April, so we're basically done right now. We haven't set a final date, but it's going to be April.
And what platforms?
For now, it's Steam, and we're looking at other platforms as well.
Perfect. And the cost?
It's going to be $99.99.
Educational gaming can be a dirty phrase here at GDC. There's too much temptation to make a game not fun in order to push across a lesson. But we're here with a studio that thinks they figured out the right formula to make a game both entertaining and educational. I'm speaking with Vincent from Ace Adventure Studio, who's going to explain what they've done to bring chemistry to the life of a gamer. Vincent, what is this?
So Camp Caper, right, is actually a chemistry role-playing game. It's for teenagers aged 10 to 14 years old, right? So these children aged 10 to 14 years old, when they play the game, it's going to be a typical RPG game where there'll be quests that they need to go to. But the secret behind it is that the elements or the kind of things that they collect are actually chemistry-related. All right, and they combine all these elements to become particles. We call it particles, which is actually pets and particles, all right? And they use it in battle. And all these pets have it's chemistry behind it. So, for instance, one of the pets, we call it Cryo. So what Cryo does in a battle, it freezes things. So, and that's what Cryo or Nitrogen does in real life. So that's pretty much how it works in the game, yeah.
So the mechanics are you have to collect individual elements in order to complete quests. That part of an RPG we all understand. But how do you make it educational without going over that edge, without suddenly seeming like, oh, this is just a chemistry table that I need to memorize?
So the game itself, about 50% of it is a game. So we have done a lot of testing with kids and teenagers aged 9 to 14 years old. So when they pick up the game, they don't realize that there is learning behind it. So they pick up the game, they play the game, and for the first 5 to 10 minutes, it's just game. So what we did in that 5 to 10 minutes is we hooked the children, and the chemistry come in after that. So that's what we did. Yeah.
Throw some more situations at me. What chemicals would I collect, and how would I use them in game?
So another one is what we call lithium. All right, but in the game we call it lith, L-I-T-H. So what it does is that in real life it is what we use in battery, right? So you need to find this lith particle to activate a portal. All right. So what we're trying to do here is to build relations that lith lights up a portal, so because that's what is being used in real life. Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, Vincent, if they wanted to find out more about this game, more about your studio, where should they go?
First is that you can go to iOS App Store, all right, or Android Play Store. Type Camp Caper and you can buy the game. But if you want to find out more about the game, first go to campcaper.com.
I'm talking to Lorenzo at the Omni booth. So if people haven't seen Omni before, give him a quick rundown. I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. This guy's running around. He's not moving anywhere. But give him a brief overview.
Yeah, so the Omni is actually an omnidirectional treadmill that allows players to walk or run in 360-degree virtual environments.
So how is this tracking his feet? Like, how does it know how far you've walked?
So we actually have two IMU sensors that attached onto each of the shoes that the user wears. And that basically sends all foot movement via USB to the computer.
Very cool. And it looks like he's using special shoes. Are those required?
Yeah, so the Omni does come with their own special shoes. It's just a very low-friction sole that really complements our concave base to emulate as if you were running or walking on a regular treadmill.
So what is the advantage of having one of these if you're experiencing VR?
Well, right now, there's for some people, there's the notion of sim sickness, of simulation sickness. When you're sitting down, you're moving, but your body's not physically moving, and that can be disorienting for a lot of people. You're also limited within certain games and applications. So the Omni actually gives you the opportunity to physically move in these virtual environments and kind of just get into that greater immersive state.
Right. And about how long does it take, like, from getting the box at your home to set it all up?
Well, I actually set one up at my home, and it took me maybe about 8 minutes, 9 minutes, just, by myself.
So pretty easy. And what's the price point that you're aiming for?
So we now are accepting pre-orders for $6.99 on our website, Virtrix.com.
And it's not out yet. This is in beta right now.
Exactly. So we shipped a few beta units. We have about 5,000 pre-orders, so we hope to get through those orders, start shipping Q3 of this year.
And does it work? Is there a specific set of games that this works with?
It's compatible with any PC game that really just requires a controller. And the Omni is essentially just a giant game pack or a joystick. So any PC games.
So any PC game that has controller compatibility. Basically, your feet are now a gigantic joystick to run around.
Exactly. I mean, technically, it's more if the game is compatible with the headset. I mean, the Omni will work with any game. But we are compatible with, the Oculus, the HTC, Samsung Gear VR via Bluetooth and whatnot.
Is there anything in the future for Omni, or is this what you're developing right now?
There may be future iterations of the Omni. We're always working on further developing it. A lot of the feedback will come from our Pathfinders and our beta program, and then we'll go from there.
Great. Any release date, kind of, hopefully?
Well, as of now, we're aiming for Q3 to start shipping our current orders, but orders can now still be placed today.
Where can people find out more if they want to pre-order?
www.virtrix.com.
This Twit Live special is brought to you by Texture. Now, thanks to pizza, we can binge eat. Thanks to Netflix, we can binge watch. But thanks to Texture, we can consume all of our favorite magazines in one place. Now, Texture is the place to go when you know what you like. When you know the publications that speak to you, when you know the readings, the stories, the little bits and pieces of information from around the world that you want combined into your single app, your single pane of glass. Texture has completely reimagined the magazine reading experience. They go beyond offering the same magazines that you get on newsstands in electronic format, and they understand that you want something special, something that fits your digital life. With Texture, you get the magazines that you know and love, plus exclusive features and videos from magazines like Macworld, Time, and Men's Fitness. You can tap into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere with the Texture app on your smartphone or tablet. It's easy to remain culturally curious with top stories and new and noteworthy sections updated daily in the Texture app. Now, I love that Texture has made it easy to find the articles that I care about. It will actively go out and find the things that are important to me, the tech stories that move me, the political stories that anger me, the stories about the world that I think I need to know. I no longer have to waste time looking for interesting content. Texture brings it to me. Now, I want you to sign up for Texture right now. Gain yourself insider access to all the content from the world's most in-demand publications. You can even share your subscriptions with your family. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to visit texture.com/twit. That's texture.com/twit to sign up and get your free trial today. You'll gain immediate entry to all the top magazines, including back issues and bonus video content. Try Texture for free right now at texture.com/twit. That's texture.com/twit. And we thank Texture for their support of this Twit Live special. Here at the Game Developer Conference 2016, VR is the big buzzword. But if you look closely, there are a few vendors who understand the importance of AR. That's why I'm speaking with Eitan from Google, specifically from their Project Tango, who's going to explain what they've done to advance the state of AR. Thank you very much for speaking with us. What is Project Tango?
So Project Tango is really about teaching mobile devices to see and understand the world around them. And we do this by adding special sensors to mobile phones and tablets that give them more information about the world. Specifically, we add a wide-angle camera to the device to give it a very wide field of view of the world as it moves. And we also add depth sensors to these devices as well that allow them to see in three dimensions. And by fusing the information from these sensors together in our software algorithms, we can track the full position and orientation of the device as it moves through space, as well as perform 3D reconstructions of scene geometry by using the 3D camera in conjunction with our motion tracking technology.
Now, walking through the halls of GDC, as we mentioned, there are a lot of vendors who are touting their new VR products. What are the unique challenges of building an AR product versus a VR?
So augmented reality products need to be tied to the real world. And so there's a component of AR that involves sensing your environment. You're starting to see some of these problems in VR as well, actually, when you talk about some of the systems that let you move around your space. You know, you put on a VR headset and you might hit your couch. And with Tango, this is a challenge we've had for a long time. When you place a virtual cat in the world, it needs to know that it can jump onto your couch or go behind your couch, those sorts of things. So it really is a challenge to not only track the position of the device in space, but also understand the environment in which the device is in. And that's a little bit different for AR over VR.
Oh, here at the booth, you actually have some very interesting demonstrations of AR, of Project Tango in use, where you've nailed a digital layer on top of the real world. I'm always fascinated by that because the really good AR products make those two layers look seamless. There is not that lag where one layer seems to slide on top of the other. How do you do that successfully?
So there are actually a lot of components to get that to work really, really well. The first is that the device has very accurate timestamps, so we know exactly when an image was taken, and this allows us to relate that directly to the position of the device at that exact time, which is really, really important to make augmented reality characters look like they're in the world and to, you know, stay really fixed. Another challenge that we have is around making sure that it's easy to bring these characters into the physical world. So again, modeling the environment in 3D and providing that up to developers, you know, through our APIs, so that you as a developer don't have to worry about, you know, what's going on under the hood or the computer vision algorithms. Instead, you get just a 3D mesh in Unity and you can make that work.
One of the hallmarks of every Google project has always been the idea of building the technology, building the framework, and then letting the developers figure out how best to use it. Where can it be a great example? Where can it actually be a productivity booster? What are you hoping to see from the developers as they pick up Project Tango, as they build VR into the products? What would be the dream scenario for Google?
So for us, we're really about enabling developers, as you mentioned, and our focus is really on providing tools that lower the barrier to developing with this kind of technology. And Project Tango is really one of the first, if not the first, platforms where on a mobile device you can walk around, you know, freely in a large-scale environment and build these kinds of experiences. And we're just kind of skimming the surface with what developers have been able to produce. We think there are three really interesting areas where developers have been focusing. So one is gaming, and we're here at GDC showing off some of those experiences. Another one is utility, so think measuring in your room or placing furniture in your room where you can buy a sleeper sofa online and not have to worry that it doesn't fit in your space. And the third one is actually indoor navigation. You know, so going from place to place in areas where GPS doesn't work with a much, much better solution than Wi-Fi where you don't get the precision that you need on a measurement. So those are kind of the three areas where we hope that developers will build experiences. And we're starting to see things that we didn't even think of, which is always great.
Let's get down to the brass tacks. We have an audience out there. I'm sure some of them are hot and heavy on this. They'd love to start developing. If they wanted to get into this, what do they need? What kind of hardware do they have to buy? How do they get into the development program?
So today, it's actually pretty easy to get up and running with Project Tango. You can go to the Google Play Store and you can buy a development kit. They're $512 and they're available today. Once you have a developer kit, we have a lot of documentation and an SDK online, and that's all free. You can download that and get up and running. We have APIs for C, for Java. We have engine integrations with Unity and also now with Unreal. So it's really easy to get up and running if you use any of those platforms, if you're an Android developer, or if you've been working with one of these game engines. And then towards the future, in the summer, Lenovo is building the first Project Tango smartphone. And so we're actually launching it this summer, and that's when consumers will start to get their hands on this technology as well.
I'm standing with Spencer Hooks. He's the director of Dolby Gaming, who's going to explain what Dolby has done to expand your mind and your colors and your range. Spencer, Dolby Vision, to the unenlightened user, might look just like HDR, high dynamic range, that we've seen at CES, we've seen at NAB, which is a fantastic technology, but Dolby's gone one step further. Tell me a little bit about what Dolby Vision does.
So Dolby Vision, the goal of Dolby Vision is to really instill the creator's intent throughout the entire ecosystem to make sure that decisions they're making about how their content is shown end up in the end devices consistently, so that anytime they are creating content and a viewer watches that, they get a consistent experience that's really true to the vision of the artist.
And this has been a sticking point for gaming for the longest time, which is, depending on the specs of the machine, the type of monitor you may have, it will change not just the picture, but really, as you mentioned, the intent of the artist.
Right.
Now, HDR does expand the range. So we get brighter brights, we get darker darks. But Dolby Vision, I've heard, also expands the color gamut that's available to the developer. How does that work?
Yeah, you're right. So the color gamut is wider, meaning that there are more colors available. So the color space that we see on televisions is an additive color space. And so that means that in order to make a bright color, you will need to, let's say you want to make a bright blue, you need to have blue, but you also then to make it really brighter, you need to add red and green. And what that does is it desaturates the color, and really you end up with white if you make the brightest you can possibly make. And so with Dolby Vision, it's not just brighter, but also a wider color gamut, meaning you can have colors displayed on Dolby Vision televisions that you actually can't see on a standard television. So you can think of one example that people often give is the London buses, those red buses. You'll see double-decker buses in London. The color of those buses is actually out of gamut for a standard television. But with Dolby Vision, you can actually see that displayed correctly, and actually it'll look like you're there in London with the bus.
I can see this kind of technology becoming very important for VR, because one of the things about VR is, yes, it gives you an immersive world. Yes, it gives you the ability to semi-move around. But if the color is off just a little bit, or if the shading is off just a little bit, or if it doesn't quite look the way that I expect things to look when I'm looking at things in the real world, then I lose that suspension of disbelief. How would a developer come to Dolby and say, can you help us develop our next title? Or can you help us develop our next technology?
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen is that technology like Dolby Vision really does help increase the immersion and also the realism that you see as a viewer. And you actually get with Dolby Vision sometimes a more three-dimensional effect, because some of the cues that your eyes and brain use to get 3D are not just the parallax that you think of with 3D glasses, but actually more information about the edges and contrast that you see. And so if you look at some of the Dolby Vision displays, you'll actually see sometimes it looks like a three-dimensional display, even though it's not really. And so, yeah, we're really excited about how that can be applied to games and also VR as well. I mean, oftentimes people talk about the refresh rate or the resolution of a display, and what we're trying to do is make sure that we can actually talk to people about a better image that isn't based just on those two numbers, but actually based on each pixel that's there on the screen displaying more information.
Spencer, thank you very much for speaking with us. Thank you for sharing your tech. Now, if they wanted to find out more about Dolby Vision, about what you can do for your developers, where can they go?
They can find us at Dolby.com or developer.dolby.com.
We're here at the Independent Gaming Pavilion at the Game Developer Conference 2016. Chad is playing a game called Super Hot. Now, Chad, this is a weird kind of game, because time only moves when you move. So what are you doing?
You move. So this is almost, you could consider it almost like a puzzle game, because there's certain elements of where people are, where they... Oh, I just got wrecked. of certain people where people will almost always enter at the same spot. But time, as you said, moves only when you move. So you're doing a weird sort of, I need to be in the right place at the right time, and I sort of control all of that. So I could have thrown the bottle at that first guy, but now this time I'm going to hold it for the second guy who's firing these bullets so that you can see move past me in a very slow manner. And so I'm going to use this
to get wrecked. It's like a combination of Groundhog Day and, Edge of Tomorrow and a Stargate episode, because you can set up every action you're going to do. And it is a puzzle. You go back every time you get killed, and you try not to get killed the next time around.
Absolutely. And let's see. I finally got this guy. He picked back up his gun.
Chad with a shotgun. Gentlemen, it is time.
Absolutely. So this is, I think, one of the newest and freshest games out there. This is a game that was actually released as a demo online a while ago, and now this is their actual release available to the public. I'm trying to dodge bullets here. Don't lose your head, he says, because I just got a headshot. And there's also different aspects of, which weapon. So I ran out of ammo. I think I just shattered a shotgun. I believe that's what I just did. So, very, very cool and sort of fresh game here at GDC.
There you have it. If you ever wanted to pretend like you were Neo from The Matrix, you got to try Super Hot. A while ago on Twit, you may have seen Leo Laporte and friends play a game called Keep Talking and Nobody Explodes. Well, we couldn't walk by the booth of Steel Crate Games without talking to Brian Fetter to explain why that game came about. Brian, your game brought us so much enjoyment. Tell me what made you create it.
So the game came out of Global Game Jam back in January of 2014. Alan Pesaluki, Ben Kahn, and I, we were all there, and we had our dev kit one, so for Oculus Rift, from a Kickstarter, and we wanted to make some kind of VR game. And what we noticed was a lot of people would say, hey, we haven't seen an Oculus Rift before, we want to try this out. So we set it up, people were doing a roller coaster demo, and the thing we noticed was everyone was standing around and just watching the person doing it and waiting, and you just look at that and you think, hey, there must be a way to engage people, so they're not just waiting around. Especially with VR coming out, and people would probably only have the one headset, but they'd want to show it to people. They'd want to have a party where people could demo it. So making a game where you can involve more people seemed like a great idea. Having multiple headsets was very unlikely, especially if you were going to a party. So we wanted to have some way to involve them without them having to be in VR with them. And really, having other technology, like a network computer, again, makes it too complicated. So we really wanted to simplify it. We thought, how can we do this? And one of the ways that came to mind was, we could use paper as the other side. So you have really high-tech, incredibly low-tech, and see how we can implement those together. So the scenario that we came up with after brainstorming a couple ideas was the one you've probably all seen before, where someone doesn't know what they're doing, they have a bomb in front of them, they call into some kind of command center, and someone has to talk them through it, and it usually doesn't end well. And that was basically what we wanted to reproduce.
We've seen games like this. I'm thinking of Artemis specifically, where you break up the responsibility so that no single gamer has the ability to win the game or to do well in the game without the cooperation of his or her teammates. Is this something that you're going to expand upon on Steel Crate Games? Of course, this is a hit. People want to play it. In fact, we want to play it on Twit again. Where do you see this going next?
Games where you have players that are working together but have different roles really excite us. So I would definitely say that it's something we're looking at possibly doing in the future. We haven't picked out what we're going to do next, but it's definitely one of those things that's really intrigued us. See, actually, Artemis is one of the things that we saw that kind of led to this idea of having multiple people doing different roles. And the dynamic you see when people have that, everyone's working together, but everyone's doing different things, is everyone can really cooperate without competing, because you're not competing with someone to do the best score on the same thing. You really all need each other, and you need to all help each other to make sure that things are going to go well. And it really helps bring people in that might not be that competitive, may just want to be cooperative with people. And that really brings in a completely different type of gamer, and that's something we really like.
Brian, if they wanted to try your game, if they wanted to get it, download it, use it on their device, where can they go?
So there's two places, three places you can get it right now. So there's on Steam, you can find it there. Humble, they have a website where you can buy a DRM-free version. You'll also get a Steam key. And also on the Oculus Store on Samsung and Oculus's Gear VR platform. That's a mobile, you take a mobile phone like the S6 or S7 or Note 5. It puts it into a headset, and then you can play in virtual reality that way.
Part of GDC is the inspiration that it brings to young developers, which is why I'm standing here with Catherine Fox from USC Interactive, who is a student developer, and you've created Chambara. Now, I just played a round of Chambara, and I got to say, it's not your typical sword bash. There's actually a little bit of creative insight that's involved. Tell me what led you to develop Chambara.
About 2 years ago, like 2014, five, six of us got together and pitched this idea to Dare to Be Digital, which is like a game design competition over in like Abertay University, Scotland. And we had 9 weeks to kind of like jam together a game. And we got together like a really solid prototype. And then a little time goes by, we win like a BAFTA award for it. And then we decide to bring it on as our like thesis project at USC. So that now they're like our team is like 20 people. We're bringing it here to GDC, and then USC is also acting as our publisher. So hopefully we'll see a commercial release very soon.
Now the gameplay is intriguing. I mean, you've got two characters or up to four characters who have a sword and a shuriken, and that. In itself is pretty frantic. You've got a lot of people in a small area, but also because of the way you've done the colors, you can hide. You can be a black character hiding in a dark alley. You can be the white character hiding against a wall. Why did you incorporate that? Why wasn't it just a typical super chromatic world?
Well, very early on, we kind of realized, I think the idea originally came from an episode of Samurai Jack. I think it's called like Jack versus the Ninja or something, and it's all about that. It's like one person is dressed all in black, one person is dressed all in white. They're hiding in these two colors, and very quickly we were like, this kind of seems like something we can do. Like, it seems like a really interesting idea. So we kind of played with it a little bit, and it turned out to be very possible. It took into account like all of our skill levels. Like it was very scopable. It's something we could do, and we just kind of like took that idea and ran with it. So yeah, and then we tried to build it out and make it more interesting over the years, and now it's this. It's great.
Catherine, I got to ask, we've got some very young, precocious techies in our audience, people who are thinking about becoming developers. If they were thinking about making something like this, working with a team to create something, to turn it from paper into something that's actually playable, what kind of advice would you want to give them?
Well, before you even have an idea, I would advise people to like get together with people that they want to work with. Like, even before the idea, the people that you're working with, I think, is more important. And then that's just my personal opinion. But, like, I would rather work on, when I'm getting a project together, I think first about the team members that I'm working with. So just work with people that you respect. Work with people that you can work with. But, I mean, the project is really cool, too. Like, decide on something that you're all passionate and you want to work on. Yeah.
We've been speaking with Catherine Fox, the developer, lead developer, I'd say. The lead artist of Chambara. Now, if they wanted to try this game, if they wanted to see the progress and maybe get it for themselves, where can they go?
Well, we don't have a demo available for download on our we don't have a demo available on our site, but we do have some developer diaries coming out. I think our first one just dropped today, so you can like keep track of those. We have a newsletter. Definitely like sign up for that newsletter and follow us on Twitter to follow our progress. We're hoping for a release date somewhere this year, like maybe like the end of summer. Yeah.
Thank you very much for talking to us, and thank you for putting work into something like this. It's the new games, the interesting games that really drive the genre. I'm Father Robert, and if you want some action, Chambara.
So we are here in sort of the controller arena at GDC, and I'm talking to Jim and Leia. Now, what am I looking at here? What is going on with this sewing machine and these guys who look like they're gaming? What's happening?
So this is our two-player territory control game for the embroidery machine. It's the portable version of our two-player territory control game for the quilting machine. And so, yes, these fellows are, in fact, gaming. They're viciously trying to gain territory for their team by picking directions to travel in, marking that space with their embroidered insignia, and competing to get as many of those tiles as possible.
So this is an embroidery PvP territory map game. This is a tile-like control game. So what is required in order to play this if you were just going to play it with your friends?
Well, okay. There's three levels here. Okay, at the top tier, you could buy yourself a quilting machine. Now, you're going to have a great time with that because you'll be able to make quilts, and you could also play this game on it. Now, at the middle tier, you could go on eBay like we did and get yourself a consumer-level embroidery machine. These are actually pretty cheap on eBay, but you're going to have to reverse engineer the software stack that runs it. Now, at the very lowest level, you could just take a picture of one of our boards and get a marker pen and play with the marker pen, because really this is a game for a single-line device.
Single-line device. What does that mean? Just like a marker?
Exactly. So one of the constraints with this sewing machine is it has to sew a continuous path. It can't lift up and move somewhere. So actually, unlike a marker, it's like a marker you have to not take off the table or whatever.
Great. So how did you come up with this concept? What was the inspiration?
So this game came out of a one-week game jam that we held back in July. We had a visiting colleague who's also very interested in procedural generation stuff for textiles. In particular, we said, come to our textiles lab, let's do some kind of jam. We were particularly interested in doing something for the quilting machine because our colleague Jillian Smith is very interested in quilting. So we said, okay, what would it take to do a game, an actual game, on the quilting machine? And as Jim was saying, this is a single-line game. That constraint comes directly out of the fact that it's a quilting machine. You always have to sew with the, you know, lay down thread as you're moving. You only get one position. There's only one needle, etc. So,
yeah, that's great. And so I'm noticing there looks like there's multiple sort of pressed linen. How many is every single map different?
There are eight available maps, but there's a board per game because you mark up the board as you're playing. Winner gets to keep the board. That's one of the perks. That's hopefully why people are getting competitive, because they want to keep that fabric for themselves.
That's great. Now, so we've got about, like, you know, very wide. Okay, so we're using an embroidery machine to play the game. Now, actually, what's the strategy? How are they actually playing?
So generally, the key is to set yourself up so that you can capture towns. Towns are worth a lot more points. They're the pink squares on the board. They're worth 3 points, where every other square is worth 1 point. So you basically want to, if you can't directly capture a town, you want to move to a position where your opponent can't help but move to a position where you capture a town.
Gotcha. And so I'm seeing, it looks like suns? Are those the yellow squares, green squares, blue squares, and pink squares? Pink squares are towns. And then do the other squares represent some sort of strategy, some sort of...
So the various tiles have various difficulty levels. So I think of them as fields, rivers, and forests. The iconography there is intended to evoke sort of traditional quilting, fantasy, medieval, whatever. But so if you think of them as fields, rivers, and towns, that indicates a level of difficulty it takes to get through that tile. So a field is a one-point tile. You could move through up to four of those. You've got 4 points of effort to spend per turn. Rivers take 2 points, and forests are three. So...
Very cool. And how long does a game last?
Well, we've been seeing games last between 20 and 40 minutes. Some folks have been cutting out early. You can do like a play till three towns are captured. The full length game is play till all six are captured.
Gotcha. And is there any way to get in some sort of scenario where you've accidentally blocked off every single like snake where you can't escape?
You can go back over captured tiles. In fact, it's somewhat strategic to do so. If you go over a tile that's already captured, that tile now becomes valueless. So if it was formerly your opponent's tile, if you go back over it, they no longer have that point. If it was formerly your tile, you no longer have that point. So it might be strategically good to set up your opponent to go back over their own tiles.
Well, this is very creative. It's very cool and also very strategic. Very cool. So this is the score is being sewn. Oh my gosh, that is ridiculous. That's amazing. It's really cool to see in a world of multi-threading and multi-threaded processors that we're seeing a single-threaded game here. So it looks like
We have one person with a one. I do want to wait until 18. Oh, my gosh. The suspense. He crushed you. Well, thank you so much for talking with me and showing off this great... Is this a research project or... Because it looks like...
Side project just to get our creative juices flowing.
Very cool. So where can people find out more?
DisneyResearch.com/project/threadsteading.
I'm here at the Alt Control Pavilion of GDC 2016. And I got to tell you, it doesn't get any more alt than this. This is the controller for Planet Liquor. And just like the name might sound, to control your character, you got to eat. I'm standing next to the team who developed this unique idea. Gentlemen, why?
Yeah. So this is the collective brainchild of all of us artists. We made this in 48 hours for a video game jam at this gallery we all work out of in New York City, Baby Castle's Gallery. And the theme of the game jam was You Are the Monster. So we really wanted to create a game that brought together all of our different backgrounds. Frank as a developer, Otis as an artist, and myself as a food interaction designer. And together we created Planet Liquor.
All right, let's talk about the design of the game. Now, it's a very interesting design, very colorful, and of course it has to work with this controller. What gave you the idea of making a lickable monster?
Well, we started out by thinking about the prompt for this game jam that we were taking part of, which was You Are the Monster. So we were thinking about how can we make a whimsical, sort of happy monster that's not really scary and that the player can empathize with. And that's how we came to this monster.
Okay, so interesting concept. I mean, we like interesting concepts at GDC. But I'm thinking there's probably a couple of other ways to control a monster than with your tongue. What was the idea behind this? I mean, I know you said that it sort of combined a lot of your passions, but what... why did you create it this way? Why three buttons? Why three controls? And why in this format?
We wanted to take something which had been previously in the realm of more like generative art and that kind of stuff into a real interactive video game fun experience. And that's, I think, what we did with this game.
Frank, let's get you into the mix. I mean, you're the hardcore game developer here. What does it take to create something like this? Because you're not just making the software, you're also making the interface.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that what would be unique to this project is that testing it is a really difficult way to do it. Like, you have to plug in this device and you have to have ice ready for it. So while I'm working on it just on the computer and I'm playing with just the keyboard, I have to think a lot about how somebody would be playing this, and it would be very different from an interface on the computer. So on the computer, it's actually really easy to play this game. It's really easy to beat it. But I kept that in mind, and I basically, I mean, very simply, like, I tried to make it easier. Like, I tried to make it easier, keeping in mind that people are going to have their first experience playing this game is probably going to be their only experience playing this game. So I kept that in mind as I made it. And it actually kind of worked out. Like, it seems like the difficulty is pretty good for somebody who's just picking this up and playing it for the first time.
Well, gentlemen, in just a second, we're going to force my co-host, OMG Chad, to do some Planet Liquor. But if they wanted to find out about your design, if they wanted to find out about your passions, about your skills, where should they go, all three of you?
You can find out about alternative food controllers and my food design studio at Mouth Arcade. You can also find our team and this particular video game at licking.space.
You can find me at my social, which is Sit on a Pan Otis.
I do a lot of game jams. If you participate in game jams, we may come across each other. I have a website, a-o.in, and I'm part of a video game collective in New York City called Baby Castles.
Gentlemen, thank you for one of the most truly unique items here at GDC 2016. Now, if you'll excuse us, Chad's got a lot of licking to do.
I don't know what flavor that is, but it's okay.
Lick harder, Chad!
Okay, I'm going to brown.
Flavor down!
Flavor down! Here we go. Oh, the brown one's right there.
So Chad is currently floating through space, happening across planets, and then licking them out of existence.
Yeah, we got purple back. Here we go. No, wait. Go back to pink. Ah! Oh, darn it! Oh, I died! Ah! Darn it! I only got 5 out of 6.
Well, there you have it, folks. That's Planet Licker. Just remember, change the controller between players.
So we're just here on the GDC floor, and look who I ran into, Daniel, who is one of the developers of Minecraft Pocket Edition. So Minecraft Pocket Edition did have a really cool announcement yesterday, which is Gear VR integration. Are you excited about this new way to see Minecraft in virtual reality?
Well, I am. Did you enjoy it?
I really enjoyed it a lot. I was actually really blown away because we had seen Windows 10 Edition before, and the Pocket Edition and Windows 10 Edition code base is very, I mean, is it the same or is it similar?
It's very similar, I would say. Like, it all comes from the same part, and we just, like, all the different platforms go on it, and, you know, it works.
Perfect. And so I feel like Pocket Edition is so much more exciting because I mean, who's playing on Windows 10 Edition? You know, everyone and their kid is playing on Pocket Edition. And so the transition from your world to VR is so much more seamless.
Yeah, the first time I put on the headset and you realize how high the blocks are and how immersed you get, that was like a whoa moment. And so,
now, did you work on that code or was that someone else?
No, not just me. Like the integration of having the 3D has been a whole team. With we got Tomo and a whole team in Redmond that's helping us out. And just the rest of the game is the Pocket Edition as you know it. It's just, you know, you played it?
Yeah, oh gosh, I love Pocket Edition. I don't play it as much as the PC Edition. It's fantastic. And also, anyone who comes up to me and says that they're playing Minecraft, I basically just assume that they're playing Pocket Edition because of just how popular it is. I mean, mostly, you know, kids, even parents, you know, I'm just assuming that they're playing Pocket Edition because it's so much more of a user base than the PC Edition. So, talking about Pocket Edition, you're a developer. What is there now to do next with Pocket Edition?
Oh, well, as some of you know, and you know, we talked about it a little bit before. I'm like a huge Minecraft fan myself. It's ridiculous. I play a lot of PC, which is like where stuff is at, really. And I totally understand why you play it. And just having all that extra material to play with. So like right now, we don't have the ocean monuments. We don't have the dragon or the end or so many little things. People keep asking me where's the horses, and you can keep naming it all this stuff, and it takes time. It's a lot of work, and I wish we could do it faster because I also kind of want to switch back to like having it either on Windows 10 or having it on my phone. I can just like on the train on the way to work, and you know, I wish you could do it faster. I really
so feature parity with PC Edition seems like where the Pocket Edition is going. Would you have okay? This is. Don't quote you, and we're not going to tell anyone.
Right.
But how long would you just, like, guesstimate how long that would take? A year, 2 years, a month? No, I'm just kidding.
Well, it depends on how good it goes. Like, right now, I've been working on Pistons for a while, and I did a sneak preview thingy, like, 2 weeks ago, I think, right before we went here. That took a lot longer than I wanted it to. And that's mainly the reasons like that. Like, I've been working together with the team in Redmond and together with the colleagues over at Mojang in Sweden. And it's helpful. Like, some things just are a little bit more difficult than we wanted them to be. And it's a lot of work. But, you know, we all want the best Minecraft we can. So
when it's ready is basically when you get the time.
well, we push out the frequent update as often as we can so people see that, like, hey, we're not sitting on our asses all day long. Sorry for, like... But, like, we are, like, working as hard as we can. And, like, I think for especially Pocket Edition and Windows 10, like, there's been quite a few updates. Like, we went from not even having a Nether to having that plus so much more. And, like, we'll keep on crunching stuff out. And I hope, like, if it was up to me, like, yesterday would have been perfect, right? And guesstimate that. We have producers now. It's great. They have a planning. It's not my problem anymore.
I'm just a code monkey, yeah.
Well, that's what I want to be anyway, so that's where my passion is, yeah.
That's fantastic. I mean, just my own personal opinion, the last year since the Microsoft acquisition, how quickly we've gotten to where we are now has really been impressive, and I think that it's been good for all of Minecraft. Thank you so much for talking with me, and I hope you enjoy the rest of GDC.
You want to play on my server with me?
Oh, yeah. Don't you have a Realms?
I have a Realms. Can I invite you?
Invite me.
Okay, good.
Chad, it's been a long, long day. We got here early in the morning. We've gone through all the halls. We found what we needed to find. I'd say that we got the heart of GDC.
I really do think that we saw everything that was worth seeing here at GDC. There's a lot. And, yeah. I mean, if there is one thing that I could pull away from GDC, it's that VR is on the edge of, I mean, like, it's so close. Everyone is behind it. Everyone is doing something. It seems like every single platform has something. And all we need are games.
Yeah. And you know what says that to me? The fact that we are finally at that point where we're starting to see a winnowing of the players in VR. Because it used to be enough that you had something VR-y.
You're right.
It was VR-ish. It had a VR feature, and people were excited about it. Now it's, well, unless you've got content, and unless it's actually well-programmed, so there's no glitches, so I expect it to be an actual game,
right,
then you're not a real VR company. I think you're right. I think next year we're going to see these companies actually turn it on. Say, okay,
exactly,
we're ready, we've developed, here we go.
Or maybe at E3. Like, yep, maybe there'll be actual games, not just experiences in virtual reality. Yeah, right. I really hope that's the start.
Now, of course, VR was the big story, but beyond VR, we've also seen quite a movement in, I'm going to call it, alternative student-based development. We've seen a few wacky, zany pieces of technology. Obviously not going to make the market.
No. No.
But I love to see that because it tells
me. That's what GDC is all about. It's the Game Developers Conference. So we got to see a lot of people who are developing things that really aren't for the mass market, that are for the wacky, for the make you smile or make you think about game design in a completely different way. So I'm really glad that we got to show a lot of that.
Yeah. It's part product, part inspiration, and part never going to see the light of day, but at least we got to see it here at GDC. Now, Chad, of course, if they wanted to find you, they got to go to your YouTube channel.
YouTube.com/OMGChad for my own tech coverage. I'm focusing on video game coverage, so more of this, basically. And then also YouTube.com/OMGCraft if you like Minecraft.
It won't be the last time that we see you back on the Twit TV network. Hopefully we'll see you at E3. Maybe we'll see you at Minecon. I'm Father Robert Ballister, and until you see us again covering the games that are here and might be here in the future, I'm Father Robert Ballister.
I'm Chad Johnson.
And goodbye from GDC 2016.